morning we've got James Bowman. He's a local film producer, and you often see James actually around the village when he's on another project. He's done all sorts of things. He's done a very good one on Duard House. So James is really interested in anything historical, heritage. At the moment he's doing quite a lot of recording of what's actually happening in Havelock North. James used to work for the New Zealand National Film Unit, and so I'll pass you over to James because he's going to tell you all about what he does and what he has done.
Thank you for coming along. So what we're going to do this morning is to speak a little bit about the New Zealand National Film Unit and when it was formed and what it used to do and how I got involved. And during the course of this talk, we'll be showing some excerpts of films. And some of these are really interesting if you're as old as I am. Not many people are. I'm very old and slow. So they're weekly reviews from the 1940s, just a few clips. Will be the first one I'll show a little bit later. I then want to show a short 6-minute film to illustrate something else I'm talking about. That one's about a church at Puketapu. And then later on we'll show my latest one, which is called Duard House. And if there's time at the end, just to razz you all up and send you away feeling happy, we'll show you some more little weekly review clips. Be able to see Mabel Howard. Anybody remember? First woman minister who's notorious for holding up a garment in Parliament, which I'm too shy to mention. But anyway, in about 1988, something rather odd happened in a small town at the lower end of the North Island. And you know, the local people who just lived up the road, had gone down to the shops, to the dairy to get their Saturday paper, and they couldn't believe what they saw in the middle of their street. This town didn't have much of a street, but right in the middle of it was a fire engine. And they thought that was a bit odd because there hadn't been a fire, there hadn't been any wind, there were no roofs blown off houses. There hadn't been any sirens, so they didn't quite know what this thing was doing there, particularly since the firemen were just lounging around chatting. And about that time, 4 cars arrived. Now the thing about these cars, this was in the 1980s, they were older, about 1950s. Quite nice looking, well spruced up and that. And if you'd looked around the corner, because there was one corner at the end of this street, you would have noticed that the old grocer's store, which had been empty for a while, had surprisingly and miraculously morphed into a tea rooms overnight, called the Pavilion Tea Rooms. More vehicles and people arrived and stood around, and nobody quite knew what was happening. And then a great big truck arrived, blue, and that's when everybody realised what was going on. Because on the side of this truck it said New Zealand National Film Unit. And what they were doing was setting up for the first day shooting of a Maurice G story called The Bee King, which they were filming in Paikokoriki. So at Paikokoriki we took over the town really, and do a lot of legwork first of all, and how I know that is I'm the guy who had to organise it, damn it. And production manager is a bit like stage manager in a play, I think. You're sort of holding everything together backstage. But we got on with it, and the fire engine was there, of course, not to put out fires, but we were doing a rain sequence. So they supplied the rain. And they shot the stuff, you know, they're pretty powerful hoses, shot the stuff up and then splattered down on the actors where it had to splatter down and not on the rest of us who we stood around, and that's what that was for. And so I joined the National Film Unit in 1971, and 4 years before that I'd gone to England with my wife, Desmond, sitting there. You were awake, dear?
Yes.
And I spent 2 years learning the trade at a place called the London School of Film Technique. It was a full-time course, Yes, we went off to work to pay the bills, and I sponged around learning how to make films. The trouble was, everybody was younger than me then. That's always been a problem. And when they graduated, a lot of them went off to the BBC or other television networks, but I was older than them all. They were all 21, and I was 31. So I was a bit old to be trying to get jobs then. So what I did was to do whatever films I could get to do, industrial films, fundraising films for a place that raised money for children really who suffered from sort of crippling diseases, things arising out of the use of thalidomide, I remember was one of them. And we did that sort of stuff until we felt we ought to come home, and came home late in 1970, and in 1971 at the beginning I was asked would I like to join the National Film Union. Well, there wasn't anything else to join. I mean, not really. Nobody wanted to work for television because hell, no, that was... Filmmakers were really snobby. You know, television was where you went if you couldn't succeed at filmmaking. So I started the National Film Union. Now, the sort of things that they are well known for doing are weekly reviews. The National Film Unit sort of was officially formed in 1941. It was actually there before then, but it wasn't called that, and it wasn't sort of a government body. Some sort of film activity had been going in the 1920s through the 1930s. In fact, at home I've got one film from the 1930s called Railways of the South Pacific, which was done just towards the end of 1939. So the National Film Unit set out to make lots of weekly reviews, and we'll see some excerpts soon. What they were trying to do there was to show people at home the progress of the war and show people what people at home were doing to help the war effort. So you got lots of things, all sorts of things as you will see. And this went right through to the 1950s when they stopped making weekly reviews because there was some indication, well, some people somewhere thought that the material in the weekly reviews was too much biased towards one of the political parties. That's all right, we changed the name and called it Pictorial Parades. And they were slightly different, but this went right through to 1970 when they did the last one. So there's hundreds and hundreds of these newsreel clips. And the ones I will show, just to whet your appetite, is the creation of a new suburb in Hutt Valley. It's called Ninai. And they mention in the commentary that there are further plans to make another one just a bit further up, and they're going to call that Tyke. Then there's refurbishing the Wanganella in the dry dock. There's children pruning roses. And there's a ship that they're fixing up. Those are the type of things. What's so interesting about these things is when we look at them now, you can think, my God, just about every man wore a hat. And just about no men wear hats. I mean, carpenters and that up on the roof, and young guys who all had hats. Just about all of them. They also had something else. Fags stuck in their mouths. When they talked, they'd cigarette it up. And it's those sort of things that the movies are really good at capturing. I mean, still photographs are vitally important as well, because filmmakers have to resort to them anyway, as you'll see when you see the one I did on Duart. And, you know, there were guys there building a railway in Lower Hutt. Well, you forget, what happened was they had about 20 burly guys with great crowbars and things just lifting up these huge railway tracks, you know. Everyone, get a grip of it, and on three. One, two, three, and they all would crash like that. Well, you don't do that now. And also there were guys up on the roof, no way of catching them if they fell down, and they're using hand tools because there weren't any power tools, laying asbestos on the roof. And these sort of things are really good. I remember when I went to see the manager of the film and said, I've got this great idea, Jeff Scott. great idea for a film, and he, oh God, he listened to the whole thing. He'd already made up his mind anyway. He said, well, it's a great idea, Tim. He says, but you know, we ought to be making films about things that are happening today for people who want to see them later on. I had to admit, it's a pretty good argument. That's just what I'm doing today, showing you films of then. So that's how they got to do those sort of things. All those weekly reviews, and there's lots of them down at the film archive. Well, anyway, when I joined the film unit, it was at Miramar. That had been a sort of a film studio there before, and a whole lot of houses, really. They knocked a few walls down and made a long house out of one bit in Parr Road. And at the time I joined, and I was there just on 20 years, they were making lots of publicity films, a lot to do with tourism, because the film unit had then become a part of the tourist and publicity department. So we trotted around New Zealand, film crews went around New Zealand doing all sorts of things to promote New Zealand. But we also did stuff for government departments, Ministry of Works, you know, building roads and bridges. And what I did was training traffic officers, how to pack a wool bale, civil defence is another one, all those sort of things. And most of the 35mm colour films that we did went to the cinema, went to the picture theatres as shorts for half time. Those were the days when you stood up for the God Save the Queen. Yeah. And we did travel quite a bit. The film crews went as far as India, anywhere that New Zealand was strange enough selling milk powder. So up in the islands they went quite a bit, filming stuff up there. And in around Singapore and those places, and India was as far as they went that way. And then they went to the Antarctic, which I didn't really want to go there, so it was okay. But I stayed in New Zealand. And it was, you know, it was pretty good because you had a lot of equipment there. They had every sort of piece of equipment you could think of. And so, you know, if you wanted some special effects in that, there was no problem. The film unit was a totally self thing. It had its own big processing laboratories for doing black and white and colour. It had its own camera repair shops. Obviously it had all the production departments, camera, sound, production, editing and all that. And every couple of years they'd be getting new cameras. And the old ones didn't get sent anywhere, they just got stuck up in the loft. So we could be quite imaginative in the scripts. Now what I did there, I arrived there with this bit of paper from the London School of Film Technique, and they said, yeah, no, mate, we don't want to know about that. I'll show you what we do here. So I thought, well, that was wasted, wasn't it? So I started as a production trainee at 32 or something, the oldest one around. And what you did was just carry bags around and get the car out and make sure it was full of petrol and do what you were told. And gradually, though, you went up the ladder a bit, and eventually they said, right, you're going to start writing some scripts now. We've got some subjects. My first one was training traffic officers. And it was really interesting because you had to go out and do your research. The one thing they didn't have was anyone to do research. You had to go and do your own. So you went out and did your research, and you came back, talked to the producer about it, and then you wrote out your script, which was your vision of what would appear on the screen. So it would just be in loose terms, say the film opens with a shot of a police car, whatever, traffic car speeding down the road, and you would just tell what you would see, not how you would see it. You didn't mention low angles, helicopter shots, aerials or that, just so anyone could read it and get a gist of the story. Well, the next thing you had to do was to sit around with six of your colleagues who were more senior than you, and they ripped this thing to pieces. They said, this is a load of rubbish. The one thing they weren't allowed to do, though, was to say this is a load of rubbish if they didn't straight away tell you how to fix it. Anybody can say it's a load of rubbish. We don't care about that. What we want to know is what do you do about it? So that was quite a good bit of discipline there. And then, you know, there were a few quirky things when you wanted to put in a few steam locomotives because you're a steam engine fan. And the producer, who was the top sort of production person, would say, no, we don't want six shots of steam engines in there, for heaven's sake. And you don't get to toss them. You only really wanted one in there. But you knew if you put six in and graciously agreed to drop out five of them, he'd feel satisfied and you'd get what you wanted anyway. It sort of worked like that a bit. Another thing that happened while I'm rolling here, towards the end of the film, you've spent a lot of money on all this pre-production and using cameras and having crews going out. You know, some of the crews were 30 people in a crew, some were just five. But anyway, it all costs money. And then you get right to the end where you've just got a bit more shooting to do, and they're saying, you've gone over the budget. Just gone over the budget, so you can't do any more shooting. Well, you've sort of really got them caught because they've spent $100,000 so far, and they're unlikely to can it just before you edit it. And so they used to say, well, don't do that again, you know. So you could get your things through that way. But generally, it was a happy sort of thing. I wanted to tell you, too, about some of the things we had to do when we had to build sets in places like the Waitomo Caves or out on some beach at Riversdale. I'm going to stop now, though, and show you these little weekly reviews. It's only a few minutes long. And you have a look and see how many hats you can see.
What year was this?
1945. There's a few little dropouts here. These are 70 years old.
Late on a Saturday night, the wool store of Levin and Company at Kaiwara near Wellington catches a light, and in a short time, the whole building is ablaze. Within a few minutes of the alarm being given, 12 fire engines and 70 firemen are on the job, but the fire has spread too rapidly and the store with contents is clearly a total loss. By the morning, nothing remains but some walls which for safety's sake are pulled down, a mass of twisted steel girders, blackened roofing iron and a pile of bricks. 2,500 bales of wool have been destroyed, valued at many thousands of pounds, and the building itself is a serious loss. The nearby railway line was cut for several hours and repairers kept working until communications were restored. The destruction of so much valuable wool cannot be measured just in money, but rather as a loss in clothing to a world that still needs food and clothing so badly. After more than 9 months in the Wellington floating dock, the Trans-Tasman liner Wanganella is nearly ready for sea again. Her new bow is complete, except for one plate, left to the last to provide access to the hull from the bottom of the dock. With the last plate in position, the major part of the job is finished. The bottom gets a new coat of paint, and also the ship's upper works. There is still some repair work to be done on board, but with the new bow finished, Wanganella is ready for her flotation tests, and preparations are made to lower the dock. The valves are opened, and the dock sinks slowly for the first tests. If the new bow plates prove watertight, Wanganella will be floated off. The ship's chief engineer checks the height of the water outside the hull by the draft marks, and relays the information by phone to men who are watching for leaks deep down in the hull. The dock is stopped at 11 feet to re-cork a plate that is weeping slightly, but that is quickly dealt with, and soon the dock is low enough to give the ship buoyancy. The shores which have been steadying her are removed, and a tug takes a line to tow Wanganella from the dock. When she leaves the dock, Wanganella will go alongside the wharf, where her refit will be completed in a few weeks. The successful refloating of the ship is a tribute to the men engaged in the biggest ship repair job done in New Zealand, and Wanganella will soon make a welcome return to the Trans-Tasman run. The Union Company's motor vessel Arahi is back on the Pacific run after a spell of war service as a troop ship, followed by an extensive refit in Sydney. When she entered Auckland Harbour again on her first trip to Vancouver, Arahi was all decked out for the occasion, and she's now painted white in place of her pre-war dark green. When she was launched in 1923, Arahi was the largest motor vessel in the world and carried 947 passengers. But since her refit, she carries only 486, with more spacious quarters for both passengers and crew. On her first trip, she had a full passenger list, and her re-entry into the Pacific service will help to relieve the present serious shipping problem.
At Hatai School, Wellington, roses are being planted. 4 dozen rose trees were presented by the Wellington Rose Society, who will maintain the plots for the first year and teach the children how to care for them. This is the first of a series of gifts to schools and hospitals by the Rose Society, who hope to create a greater interest in rose growing in New Zealand. At Wellington, a trial shipment of Pinus and Cygnus is being loaded for South Africa. As well as being the first soft timber to be exported to South Africa, this shipment is also an experiment in loading. Instead of loose boards, one-ton bundles are made up at the mill, and these are loaded directly onto the ship. By this method, timber can be handled six times as quickly. With these shipments, the State Forest Service is looking to the future, when New Zealand will have a large surplus of pine timber.
The first state houses at Lower Hutt were built in 1938. After 7 years, they've become part of the landscape. Their gardens are neat and well kept. The war called a halt to building for 2 years, and for the last 12 months, it's been a case of making up for lost time. 240 state houses completed here in the year have made up some of the leeway. And turning back to flats, the blocks that had been changed from flats to service hostels during total mobilization means homes for another 20-odd families. Now comes the task of providing for the thousands who are still homeless. And here in the Nainai area, a big start has been made. In the last 9 months, the housing department has built a new school for Lower Hutt. 1,000 new homes are well on the way to completion. This was the boom town of 1944, but it's a boom town that has been most carefully planned. Every house put up here fits neatly into the layout of an attractive and convenient suburb. There's more to building a new suburb than finding bricks and timber for the houses. A new reservoir is needed, this one to hold 2.5 million gallons. Drains have to be laid, footpaths and curbs put down, and new roads formed. In all ways, this is a big job. Only machinery can deal with the task of supplying enough shingle to build a new town. Backwards and forwards across the Hutt River, carry-alls are pulled, bringing 18 tons of shingle in one load. Screening the shingle is another machine-sized job, and this bucket picks up metal by the cubic yard. Then swiftly, easily, the crane swings the bucket and drops the gravel on the screen. Where shingle is handled in these quantities, a fleet of lorries is necessary to carry it for concrete, for road metal, and for railway ballast. Extending the Waterloo branch line along the eastern side of the Hutt Valley is another part of this scheme of suburb building. Here, too, speed is important, so sleeping rails have been lifted bodily from an unused track to be relayed here. By this time-saving technique, railway and houses will be ready together. For the 3,000 or 4,000 people who will live in the new houses, this railway will provide handy transport, so distance from town will be small inconvenience. In spite of all the difficulties of wartime construction, these houses are being finished to time. Substitutes have had to be found for war-scarce materials. Asbestos roofing instead of corrugated iron is but one of them. But for design, these places match up to the pre-war state. With these places nearly finished, the housing department is getting ready to build another block at Taita, a few miles further up the valley. This will be an even bigger scheme, for here 1,600 houses will be built. Building a stop bank to keep the Hutt River in its present course has been the first requirement. And now roads are being formed. Very shortly, the first houses will be going up. And within a year, there'll be yet another new suburb. For the house-hungry, this is the promised land. Raw material for glass-making is being shot into the furnace of this Auckland factory. New Zealand is well supplied with the chief ingredient, pure silica sand. For North Cape is said to have enough of the purest glass-making sand to last the whole world's glass trade for 1,000 years. This sand is so pure that it needs no cleaning in the factory. Besides sand, the other ingredients are soda, limestone, and some coke dust for colouring beer bottle glass. At the high temperature of the furnace, the sand, soda and lime melt and react chemically to become molten glass, the consistency of here, lengths of molten glass are being cut off and dropped into spinning molds. The glass emerges in the familiar form of preserving jars, which are cooled off gradually in annealing ovens. Packed in boxes, they go out to preserve summer fruit for winter use in innumerable households. The jars roll out of the ovens. This is a profiling lathe, which turns squares, hexagons, octagons, and so on. The lathe cuts fine shavings, and seems to take a man all his time. The shapes turned up make the dies for shaping fancy jars, and there's nothing fancy about these bottles, when they're empty anyhow. Out of the molds they come, and along the belt. They're still hot and soft. This bottle's no good. They forgot to anneal it. Unannealed glass bottles bounce on concrete, and would be very useful if only they didn't explode when anything is put inside them.
Well, there we are.
You see what I mean?
You know, being able to see these things, two or three things came to my mind while I was watching it. The first thing that I suddenly realised was everybody had a job. They need so much manpower, person power, I should say. Because technology wasn't how it is now. I mean, he was bolting railway lines with a huge spanner by hand. You do a power thing now or not, it'd be done. But, you know, the upside of that was that needed lots of labour. And I remember when I got sacked from a job, I was a tanker driver in Palmerston North, and I was filling up a big tank truck with 3,000 gallons of kerosene for Opakia, and I got off the top while it was filling and went down onto the ground to have a row with another driver. And while I'm down there, it overflowed at the top. And that's why you're supposed to stay there, because it's a quick release little stop valve, you know, that stop it. Time I got up, 100 gallons had gone. Now the trouble was, the boss didn't know about this, but kerosene doesn't evaporate quickly. It sits around for ages because it's sort of oily stuff. And eventually the boss sort of saw it, and I got sat, but no problems. 3 days later I had another job. There was so much work around. That was 1956, 57. I remember gentlemen used to, if you passed a lady, well, a woman, on the street that you knew, you'd raise your hat. I remember Desmond, that's my wife, gives me hell about this one, using a slate at school with a slate pencil. And that makes me feel really old. Or if a funeral was going past, you'd stand by the, you know, with your hat on. Bring them back, I say. Let's have some quality to life. Anyway, I'll just tell you a little bit more about some of the things we did at the film unit. Then I want to talk to you about filming heritage objects and the kind of special things that you have to look for. One of the things we had to do when we went out filming is we sometimes had to build sets or change things to suit our needs. And some of these things are very expensive, but were very effective too. One of the ones that we did was we were filming for the Ministry of Works, making a thing about roads, but one major scene involved a merry-go-round. Well, where do you find a merry-go-round? We found one in Hawera. You had to pay to have it trucked to Riversdale Beach, which is 30 so many miles off Masterton. And we got the Ministry of Works to bring graders in to level the beach. They leveled all the beach, well, not all the beach, so the bit we wanted, about 100 metres. And then we put this merry-go-round there. This was a film that had to start shooting at dawn. So we posted the cameraman out at Riversdale. The rest of us stayed in motels in Marston. And he was to get up and have a look and tell us what the weather was going to be like. And the reason is that one or two pieces of equipment we had to hire. It was either that or we only had one of these things, a camera lens, which was so big that the hire rate was something like £500 a day. It was just a very expensive thing, and you didn't take it out unless you were going to use it, because, you know. And so he'd have a look and jump in the car from Marston and rush out there and do this filming. And we did the filming all right. Ian Noon was one of the actors, I remember. And I was production manager on that. I don't know how we got this thing back to Hawera, but that was one of the more unusual things. The real eye-opener, though, was at the Waitomo Caves. Now, if you've been to the Waitomo Caves and you know anything about films or photography, well, films, actually, photographers can get around this. There's not enough light there to film properly. And you can't have a whole lot of light if you're going to film the glowworms. So we went in there and we filmed the things you could film. But we got the electricity department to run a power line from the road right up into the caves and give us enough light to film a few shots. Those lights are quite hot. Couldn't have them on for too long, or it would start to damage the things in there. So what we did, we filmed people, for instance, getting into the boat, pushing off into the gloom. Back in Muramar, we took over the sound stage. Now, a sound stage is a really interesting thing. When you're recording sound in films, you can get interruptions by extraneous noises, an aeroplane going past, or a chainsaw or something. And you can get shocks if someone slams a door. So the soundstage is a floating thing. It's completely in its own separate building, and if you drive a truck into the wall, the outside won't make any effect at the recording area, and you won't hear any sounds at all, apart from the ones that you're making. So okay, we're on this soundstage, and we've got the art department to recreate the glowworm caves, and this is how it's done. They put down what amounted to a shallow swimming pool. They put down some 4x2 wood, quite a big bit, as long as this room, and they put black polystyrene sheeting in it, filled it with water, and put a board across the length of it on which the camera would move. They took some, what's the other white stuff that you can form? Yeah, big piece of it, made little holes in it. They sprayed that black, they put lights. They then lit the thing so it represented a darkened scene, so there was some light in there. They first of all pushed the camera slowly across, pointing at the water, which was still and reflecting the glowworms. And then they did that again. And then they got the live footage of people getting in the boat. This is up in the editing room. Took this shot, intercut them, plus getting out of the boat and that sort of thing. Edited it into the film and showed it. And a guy, not a New Zealander, an American guy, "Well, I can't tell it," he says. "I don't know how you guys did that, but it was really superb. But it's so difficult to film in those." It just was totally believable. And that's why I wasn't upset the other day when David Attenborough said, "Oh, that thing where we were filming some animal having sex in a burrow was actually done in the studio in London, not in..." There's some things you can't do. So those were the good things. I like filming heritage things. I film steamboats, steam engines. My current project is mentioned in this pamphlet here, which Lily Baker has given me. And the thing is called the Marae Kākahu Woolshed. And that's quite a good example. We've been filming out there, and you have to really be sort of careful how I operate. I go out by myself to a place, as I did here, or anybody could do here, and I have a good look at it, and I think, how am I going to present this? Am I going to do anything in the way of choosing camera angles, or lighting, or sound, or music, or the length of shots, which will negate the feeling you get from this place? What I mean is this: you could go and film Duard House here, and you could fill up the whole film with endless commentary about facts and figures about the sort of wood and how long, you know, all that sort of stuff. You could spend ages talking about the history of it, and what you would then relegate the house to is just wallpaper. The shots in your film are just going to be this place, which is the background for me to talk about it. I like the place to speak for itself a bit, and that means have some commentary, tell some of the facts, but let's shut the commentator down for a while, and that was a big me, and my wife was pleased about that, and let's get a feeling for this place. And it's the same thing with this woolshed. Now, I went out there, saw the farmer who rents the land around it, spoke to the owner too, and they gave me the key to go in. And it's a vast place, and it has a great sort of feeling to it. So the shots I took were to sort of show the exterior, I haven't edited it yet, and show the interior and get that feeling of spaciousness, of importance, and all that sort of thing. And I'll show a film soon, it's just a really short one, about a church at Puketapu, in which I deliberately didn't tell you anything at all about the church. In fact, there was no commentary at all. And yet I'll bet you that you get a sense of the church, a sense of religion, a sense of peacefulness, a sense of history. It's just the way it's done. So when we came to Duart House, I mean, I've been up to the gardens before. I start to plan things. I have a good look round. Rose took me round to have a look upstairs and out at the Bilwin collection. Had a good look round. I went back and I thought, this is a gracious old house standing up here. It's been surrounded by the rest of us over the years. And I don't want to do anything which would make it look like some undervalued relic that nobody cares a toss about. So I thought, what will I show? I write down the main elements, the house exterior, the gardens, the collections, I'll call them, that's some upstairs, the paintings, and the ones out the back, activities, what's it used for? I mean, of what value is it to the community, other than just to come up and look at the outside? And then I would sit down and think, how to start? Well, one thing I like to do in making most films, not all, because murder mysteries I don't do, but they're different, is let the audience know straight away, where are we, when are we, what's happening? Not in a murder mystery. If you watch Midsummer Murders, they always have some guy lurking in the bushes to start with. He's got a hoodie on. A crow will go, or a dog will bark. And then somebody will get knifed to death or something. And that's so you don't change channels, you see. You get gripping. You stay with it. But we're not doing that with Duart House. So when I do play the film, you'll see how it starts to set that theme. But one of the problems was, of course, in the middle of the film, because I was doing other projects for about 3 or 4 years, so I had to stop it. They painted the house. never mind, we did a bit at the end showing the house painted. But I do think, you know, if your shots are too gimmicky or your editing is sort of deliberately short shots to up the pace, that is likely to destroy the feeling of the heritage thing. You don't see steamboats going fast like speedboats, you know, and you shouldn't edit it like that. You should get a feeling for the place and respect its integrity. That's probably what I'm saying. It's a bit hard to talk about this, but I'll be showing you shortly anyway. So let me show you this one about the church, and I'll tell you a little bit about England. So the same thing happened there. I went out to that church and I just spent a while going around it and having a look and getting a sense of it had been sort of restored and that. And you get the key at the local shop and go and have a look. And so I had a really good thing. If you had to identify some features to give a sense of the church, what would you look for? And what I decided, if I saw certain shapes written onto the paper, I would think of religion, or I'd think of a church. And those shapes, the curves of pews, the arms out in the cemetery, but just the curves really, or parts of a cross, or looking through a hole. And I was really aware of the fact that if you took an overall shot, you'd see a mess probably, because some of the gravestones are really old and tumbled down. The family had sort of died off and hadn't been able to look after them. Those sort of things. So I then went round the outside and looked through trees, and it was autumn, I think, so I also looked on the ground for leaves and thought, well, in the morning they're going to have nice little globules of dew on them, and if it's a sunny day they will look really good. So the next time it was nice and fine, I went round and I made a particular note of what time I should be there to shoot most of those shots. Now, you only had about a minute to do the curve of the pew because the sun moved. And that nice highlight on the curve of the arm was gone. And that applied to all sorts of things. So I got there and got set up and just waited, and I filmed all those shots according to how I had worked them out. It had to be a nice sunny day with blue sky. It had to be at that time of the year. You couldn't wait till winter or summer because things changed. And that's how I got those things. I also did quite a bit off the floor. That is the camera right on the carpet. In the cemetery, I looked for old things, and you'll notice those sort of picket fence things, which are really old, and I waited for the sun. It's just come round, so it caught it on the side and showed you the texture. But you know, when you look at me, the absolutely attractive thing about me are my wrinkles. When the sun catches me, I look like something else. Well, it's the same with those posts, and the old post ball thing on the top was particularly filmed to throw the background out of focus, and this thing standing there in remembrance of people who had died a long time ago. And no commentary, not even my name on it. It was just the church. So that's the sort of thinking I do when I'm trying to do things about old buildings or this, that, and the other thing there. And that's the same thing that's happening out at Maride Total, except the farmer guys let me down because he said he was going to shear 1,000 sheep and gave me a date. I didn't hear anything, I phoned him up. Oh, I said, no, I'll put it off for a while. So I said, all right, I'll phone you in a week. So I phoned him in a week. No, we're not ready yet, we're putting it off. But I'll give you a call on Tuesday, it's all right. Oh, well, we can't do it yet. He said, give me your phone number. And I said, well, you will remember to phone me, won't you? Fatal words. He never did. So I'm going ahead with the Marae Kākahō woolshed film with all the footage. We actually have at least one person here, don't worry, I won't identify you, who accidentally got into the film. We've got the back of her. Yep, so that's going down to the film archive. And that's the other thing. Drew Art, I wrote to them, I've got a contact there, and it was said, I'm doing this film about Drew Art House. I explained, you know, what it was, you know, have it was. And she said, I'd really like to get a copy of that for our archives. So I've asked for it. And the Woolshed one, and they've got another one I've done on Middle Road here. You know, they're still collecting stuff like that. Now it's time to show you the Drew Art House one.
It's 20 minutes.
So you can see, you know, there were times when I worked through that thing and I thought, this is too wordy, there's too much stuff here. Then I'd take, you know, some of the commentary out and it just didn't join together. But what you have to be careful of doing is to get music that is sympathetic to the feeling that you want to express. So it all goes back to your research, really, and you come up and you wander around and you have a look and you think, what sort of feeling do I want this building to express in the film? A place where they have lots of rowdy parties and things? Or a gentle reminder of how things were, you know, in the past? And you can get a sense of this by what people think about it. And if you talk to people who are associated with the house, or, you know it well, even if they're not part of the Drew Art House Society, you get a feeling from them as to whether they think it's a load of junk or whether they think it's something to be respected and kind of loved, really. The problem with music is that you need to have out of copyright music, and I've got an arrangement with an American composer with an un-American name called Kevin MacLeod, who allows me to use his music if he gets a, you know, a name up on the credits. But still, I was hoping nobody would laugh when we saw the picnic on the grass. The reason that somebody laughed is because they saw the fly. I didn't see the fly. When you're looking through the camera, you're not looking for the fly. And I was hoping I could say it was just a mechanical fly I put on there. But I didn't notice that even through editing until, I think it might have been Peggy when she looked at it. And I thought, oh, you can't do that again. And I haven't got that spare shot. But anyway, so those are the sort of things that happen. Any questions? Well, that's it.
Congratulations on the choice of the soundtrack. Superb. The way it has changed in movement.
Yes.
Well, usually, you know, when you get a commentator, you get one with the right sort of voice, but they have to put up with me, but I think it was reasonably suitable for that sort of subject. So that's really all I've got 3 minutes to fill in.
Well, James, this has been delightful. Thank you. We're going to have you back, because I know there are more things to see, and there are lots more that you can share with us. I think some of our best talks here have been the ones where we've had people sharing their craft with us, and I think that's what you've been doing today, and very effectively, and I've just loved it, and I look forward to next time. I just ask you to join me in thanking you.
Thank you very much.